I will present to Charles. As I said in the beginning, he has come all the way from New York to be with us today. He will share his experience from his 39-year career as executive responsible for IBM Global Workforce Diversity Programs. Mr. Charles is now retired and he runs his own company, consultancy company, Ted Charles LLC. And since Ted's speech will be in English, and since none of you diversity guys understand English, there will be a Danish translation in your conference folder. So I'm very pleased to welcome here to Aarhus, Mr. Ted Charles.
Thank you very much. This is my first visit to Denmark, and I'm having fun. And thank you for that introduction. Thank you even more for inviting me to participate in this globally distinctive program. Being present on such a prestigious occasion is a special treat, and to be allowed to address this audience is undeserved, but to be treasured nonetheless. My mission during my time with you today is to address the theme, Workforce Diversity, a Global Perspective. Before I address today's theme, I want to frame my remarks in the context of my core belief and four items I believe are the cornerstone of a global diversity and inclusion strategy. My core belief is the phrase, workforce diversity, the bridge between the workplace and the marketplace. That phrase, which I have trademarked, is the guidepost for my company. The four items I believe are the cornerstone of a global diversity strategy are, first, to identify, attract, and retain the best people from each group. Second, to organize the workplace to mobilize high-level professional development and contribution from all employees toward maximum business performance and shareholder value. Third, to assess the diversity of your marketplace and ensure you're responding to your customers as they are, not as you want them to be, and that they see themselves in your vision, your actions, and your workplace. And fourth, to use your external focus to eliminate competitive disadvantage and increase the diversity of the talent pool. In advising my clients, I never lose sight of those four objectives. Anchored in those objectives, my remarks will address three areas that I spend considerable time thinking about and that influence my advice to clients. First, the concept of seminal moments and how they should help us see past lessons learned and current challenges as both opportunity and necessity. And second, the lenses through which I see the world. And third, how one of those lenses, inevitability, has defined my view of the global environment and what I call diversity and inclusion megatrends. Excuse me. But first, let me define who I am. I am a 64-year-old black man. I was born and raised in Massachusetts. My parents were both from the American South during a time of intense controlling racial segregation. My mom from North Carolina and my dad from Florida. Until that point in time, when they met in Tennessee State University in 1941, neither of them had ever attended an integrated school, and I never attended a segregated school. Three events in the first 10 years of my life helped define who I am today. First, on April 15th, 1947, Jackie Robinson integrated today America's pastime, baseball. As you may know, there's a baseball team in Massachusetts. They're called the Boston Red Sox. My dad would not take me to see the Boston Red Sox because they were the last team in the major leagues to have a black player. But he took me to Ebbets Field. I saw Jackie Robinson play baseball. My boyhood idols were black men who performed on a national stage with distinction. The second incident was on July 26, 1948. That is the day that President Harry Truman signed the Executive Order 9981, integrating the United States Army. I was born in the midst of World War II, and the only memory I have of that time is my mom telling me about her high school boyfriend, Randolph Williamson. Randolph was on the U.S. ship, the U.S. Arizona, on December 7, 1941, in Pearl Harbor, and he died that day. The third impactful incident to occur during my first 10 years happened on May 17, 1954. The United States Supreme Court issued the Brown decision, ending the legality of separate but equal schools in the United States. Those three events were impactful to me and to our nation. They served to make it clear to me that being black should not be a barrier, but rather a motivator. Later, looking through the lenses of those events, I was able to see the world and the menu of issues as inclusive of far broader than black issues. Those issues became the foundation for me to see the world through a global lens, the lens of fairness and competitive advantage. Now back to diversity and inclusion. First, what is the goal of our diversity and inclusion focus? It is one thing in business, the pursuit of competitive advantage. Second, what is the foundation for our diversity and inclusion focus? How is it built? The answer, myths. An American philosopher, Will Rogers, said, "I don't worry about what men don't know. I worry about what they do know that ain't true." And that's what we spend our time in diversity trying to dismantle. Myths, things that aren't true. One of the phrases that I use in my company and have also trademarked is we talk to one another, not about one another. We must keep talking to one another across companies, cultures, and countries. We must keep talking. Third thought, we must invest the time to look at and think about our environment. When I look at the environment, I like to think in terms of seminal moments. I define a seminal moment as an enormous opportunity driven by necessity. And because of that necessity, we have, at least momentarily, the political, public, and social will to win, but not always the commitment or sustainability to do so. My U.S. seminal moments, the Revolutionary War in 1776, the historic gathering of women at Seneca Falls in 1848, followed by women's getting the right to vote in 1920, slavery and the Civil War, Pearl Harbor in 1941. Those are examples of the United States seemingly having the commitment to win and the sustainability to do so. Examples of seminal moments when we did not have the commitment to win. The period known as Reconstruction immediately following the Civil War between 1869 and 1973, when we had our first black elected officials. We ushered that era out and assassinated the president who had the political capability to lead us through that period. The Russian launch of Sputnik in 1957 provoked a major focus on math and science, which we did not sustain. In 1967, the Kerner Commission report that said, "Our nation is moving toward two societies, one black and one white, separate but unequal." Today, America is closer than then to being separate but unequal. And Barack Obama's election does not alter the social circumstances that exist in my home country. In the 70s, we had the gasoline crisis. This seminal moment was defined by two statements. We must reduce our dependence on foreign oil, and we must develop energy-efficient cars. We were not able to sustain either. That's more than 30 years ago, but it was impactful. I suspect that many of the people here today will not remember it, or may not have been born. But let me frame a picture for you. You got out of bed at 4 o'clock in the morning to drive to a gas station to get in line to buy gas. If people cut the line, there was a fight. Often the line worked in an orderly fashion, but the gas station ran out of gas. You took the train, you took the bus, you used a bicycle. I see a lot of those around here. You walked. You saw headlines of people in civilized America fighting at a gas station. Another seminal moment, in 1963, a national report was released entitled A Nation at Risk. And it was a statement that was riveting and intended to create a seminal moment that would galvanize America. If a foreign government had done to our schools what we have allowed to happen, we would consider it an act of war. We uttered the oohs and ahs, but we did not have the commitment to win. And so in 2008, at the centennial of the Harvard Business School, Bill Gates stated 1/3 of our children in America do not finish high school. Those are U.S. seminal moments. Globally, we have had 5, World War I and World War II. Each represent a seminal moment, and the world had the commitment and sustainability to prevail. 9/11 was a seminal moment, but it may be premature to give an evaluation. The election of Barack Obama as the 44th President of the United States is a seminal moment. While he cannot accomplish the world's expectations without the world's assistance, the opportunity driven by necessity does exist, and there is enormous hope in his ability. While his presence represents a uniform seminal moment, I believe the fifth seminal moment is embodied in 4 major challenges requiring the global collaboration we hope his leadership will help us address: economic stability, world peace, protecting our environment, and addressing poverty. Now, my second area of focus is the 3 lenses through which I see the world. They are talent, the marketplace, and the one that I will talk about, the concept of inevitability. Those shifts taking place, particularly cultural and demographic, they are so powerful that you cannot duck them, you cannot deny them, and you cannot legislate against them. I call these shifts diversity and inclusion megatrends. Megatrend 1, we the people, the changing face of America, mirrors the world. The first inevitability is applied to the United States. In 1940, America was 88% white, 9.8% black, 1.4% Hispanic, and 0.2% Asian. If you fast forward to the year 2000, and the white population is 69%. The black population is 12%. The Hispanic population is 12.5%. And the Asian community is 3.6%. Now, the 2050 projections are that America will be 50% white, 25% Hispanic, and 25% everybody else. The problem with that projection is that the census people have already discarded it. The projection now is that those 2050 projections will be achieved by 2042, and that by 2054, the ethnic minority population will be 54% of the United States. Sounds like a new majority. If you look at the United States, you see 100 million people of ethnic heritage: Asian, Black, Hispanic, and Native American. That 100 million people is larger than the individual populations of Argentina, Australia, Canada, Egypt, France, Germany, Italy, South Korea, South Africa, Spain, the United Kingdom, Vietnam, and the combined populations of all the Scandinavian countries. The shifts taking place in America are inevitable. Let's look at the rest of the world. Megatrend 2. The shift in growth in regional population will yield a shift in world power. The influence of the United States has become a question mark in many parts of the world. In Fareed Zakaria's new book, A Post-American World, he captures the thoughts with clarity. Fareed defines what the world sees, and it is not the America I grew up in. Fareed says, and I quote, "The tallest building in the world is now in Taipei, and it will soon be overtaken by one being built in Dubai. The world's richest man is Mexican, and its largest publicly traded corporation is Chinese. The world's biggest plane is built in Russia and the Ukraine. Its leading refinery is under construction in India, and the largest factories are all in China. By many measures, London is becoming a leading financial center, and the United Arab Emirates is home to the most richly endowed investment fund. The world's largest Ferris wheel is in Singapore. Its number one casino is not in Las Vegas, but in Macau, which is also overtaking Las Vegas in the annual gambling revenues. The biggest movie industry, in terms of both movies made and tickets sold, is Bollywood, not Hollywood. Even shopping, America's greatest sporting activity, has gone global. Of the top 10 malls in the world, only one is in the United States, and the biggest is in Beijing. So why is this happening? A number of things, including immigration and population dynamics. Regarding immigration, I'll state the obvious. People are moving away from their native countries. The concept of the explorer is alive and well, and they are settling in other nations. And immigration is blended with 24-hour communications access. CNN is alive and well. The world has no secrets. When you do it, it is known. Now, if you look at the top 20 countries in 1950 versus today, based on population, six on the list in 1950 are not in the top 20 today. The United Kingdom, Italy, France, Ukraine, Spain, and Poland. Their replacements, the Philippines, Ethiopia, Turkey, Congo, Iran, and Thailand. If you look at the top 10 countries today versus the projected top 10 in 2030, three important changes will take place. India will replace China as number one. Russia and Japan will fall off the top 10. And Mexico and Ethiopia will replace them. These outcomes are being fueled by a substantial shift in birth rates. It takes 2.1 children per woman to sustain a culture. The United States has dropped from 3.3 in 1960 to 2.1. The United Kingdom, 1.7. France, 2.0. Canada, 1.6. Germany, 1.4. Italy, 1.3. And Japan, 1.2. Contrast that, China, Brazil, Russia, South Africa, and Australia are all less than 2.1. And if, however, you look at the rest of Africa and Asia, you see countries with birth rates ranging from 3 to 7. If you look at the world population clock, you see the following. 33.6 births every 8 seconds, 19.8 deaths every 11 seconds, a net population gain of 32.5 people every 13 seconds. By the year 2030, 21 years from now, 30% or more of the following countries' total populations will be retirees: France, Germany, Italy, Japan, Sweden, and Switzerland. One of the outcomes of these birth rate, death rate shifts is that when you look at the top 50 cities in the world, 11 are in North America and Europe. 5 in North America, 6 in Europe. 39 are in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. This includes 15 in China and 6 in India. If you package North America and Europe together and look at the rest of the world, you see three things. The rest of the world, the majority of the world, and the world of color. And then you take a second look at North America and you are reminded that North America includes Mexico. And the projections are that the United States will be 50% ethnic minority, a changing face to the world that is inevitable. Megatrend 3, education improves the quality and competitiveness of a society and is a predictor of the marketplace. Brazil, Russia, India, China, and the African continent will generate new revenues of revenue generation, wealth, and jobs. I'm offended by the term emerging markets. It strikes me as companion to the term minority and implies poverty and other baggage. I don't like being called minority. Feels like I'm being told that I'm less than. I don't call those regions emerging markets. I call them opportunity markets. When you look at the world's 6.6 billion people, 52% of the world lives in those countries. Let me bring this point closer to home in the U.S. and use it as an example of the population shift. Everyone here is well aware that the United States is competing in a global marketplace. At least two of America's major competitors have well over a billion people, China and India. They can afford to have a population of poverty equal to the entire U.S. population and still have three times America's population to engage in the economic system. I call that affordable poverty. A few weeks ago, I was honored to be invited to speak on a panel at the Centennial for the Harvard Business School. Before our panel, there was a main tent event, an interview with Bill Gates. One of the questions was about the focus of his foundation. It was not his acknowledgement that more than half of minority youth do not finish high school in the United States, or that nearly 60% of black boys don't finish high school. I knew those facts. It was his statement that one-third of all U.S. students do not finish high school. That got my attention. That means a substantial number of white youngsters are not finishing school. That represents a national going-out-of-business strategy. It emphasizes the importance of re-energizing our commitment to redefining affirmative action. Affirmative action must be seen as efforts to eliminate disadvantage, to give people the skills they require to compete in the marketplace. The only requirement for access to this assistance must be that you're disadvantaged. I've not forgotten that I'm black and that a disproportionate percentage of U.S. citizens of ethnic heritage are poor. But the largest group of poor people in America, people who live below the poverty line, are white. They live throughout America, and we cannot afford for any of our people, black, white, brown, red, or yellow, to be poor, and more importantly, to be lacking the skills required to compete in a global marketplace. If you are poor, we have to help you, no matter who you are or what country you live in. The message must be that we cannot afford poverty. We need a massive global focus on education and access to quality health care. We have to be able to see all of our people as members of our global talent pool. What is often overlooked in a discussion of the marketplace is the issue of gender. In fact, I believe that gender mismanagement is a global issue. Globally, women continue to struggle for social, cultural, political, and economic equality. Even in the United States, the U.S. passed the Equal Pay Act in 1963, and the first legislation signed by President Obama was the Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. Somehow we didn't get it right in 1963. Women are 50% of the world's population, and they must have a seat at the table. And their struggle, their global struggle, cost the world an extraordinary economic price measured in lost talent and lost revenue. 2 years ago, I was sitting in the office of a CEO here in Europe. I told him that one of the things I thought his company needed to focus on was the issue of ethnic minorities. He responded, "Yes, Ted, you are right. We must do a better job about minorities in the United States." I listened to him and I said, "Why did you respond to me that way?" "Because I'm black and from America. I did not mention the United States. I've studied your company. I know where you make your money. France, Germany, and the UK are productive talent pools and revenue centers for your company. And they have growing ethnic populations." And he said, "Ted, you are right. But no one has ever said that to me." That was 2 years ago. The January 27, 2009 issue of Der Spiegel, the German magazine, includes an article entitled "The Country's Changing Face on Becoming Un-German." Two messages: the German population is permanently shrinking, while the foreign population is permanently growing. Ethnic Germans have a birth rate of 1.3, and immigrants, the largest group of which is Turkish, have a birth rate of 1.9. In 2005, this group is producing 30% of all the babies born in Germany. Why is this last point about religion relevant? Because this leads me to the concept I call global inevitability, my fourth diversity and inclusion megatrend. And the New York Times article that I just dropped from last week, on the front page of the New York Times last Tuesday, was two articles about faith. The first about women in Afghanistan and their growing pursuit of fairness. The second was about the recent appointment of a new bishop for New York City. He is Irish. He's the 10th bishop for New York City, because they all become cardinals to be Irish. And yet more than half of the Catholics in New York City today are Latino. Megatrend four, the fourth one, final one. Faith will play an ever-increasing role in the world economy and politics. The largest religious group in the world are Christians, at 33% of the world's population. Islam, however, is second, with 21%. But if you break Catholicism out of Christianity, Islam becomes the largest individual group in the world. If you look at the top 30 countries based on Muslim population, those countries have 1.1 billion people, or 17% of the world's population. The growth of the Muslim community is contributing to this culture change. Three recent news articles highlight that. One of them was in Australia. One was in Cary, North Carolina, and one in Boston. The one in Boston focused on Harvard University and an adjustment made to the university gym hours. They identified select exercise facilities throughout the campus community that had low usage periods. And from that data, they identified locations to be used to create women-only hours for 6 hours per week. In Australia, the drowning of four Muslims while trying to save a child made visible the fact that few Muslims could swim. Young Muslims of Australia stepped up to organize youth events, including camps, where issues such as swimming can be addressed. The world is changing everywhere. No nation is or can be immune from such change. The challenge is to manage the changes in a manner that manages and values diversity. To do so requires looking at the global environment through the lens of the global talent pool and marketplace. Doing so would reflect a global approach to diversity and inclusion. That means understanding the lessons learned from our seminal moments yesterday and today, understanding the global demographic shifts that are underway and inevitable. We know that the world will, what the world will look like tomorrow, with a clarity not previously available. We can't ignore those realities, nor can we ignore the seminal moment that is presented to us. We have wars underway. We have a global economy that is in disarray. Even when there is peace and economic prosperity, there are companies that can't find sufficient talent. Countries that worry about their schools not producing the skills they require in their workplaces, and workplace conflicts caused by myths that are viewed as fact and prevent effective teaming in both our workplaces and our nations. I am not talking about the United States. I'm talking about the world of states. We need our global team to be an effective competitor in the global marketplace. To do so, we must remember that many of the global companies headquartered in the United States earn the majority of their money outside of America. You cannot have a great business year by being great in the United States. We need a network of successful local economies, and to be successful in several of them, to have a great business year. That success requires not only a network of good economies, but also a team of local talented people in each of those regions. It is increasingly important that a global company be seen as a local company, managed and staffed by local people to be competitive in a local marketplace. And I'm very proud and honored to be joined here today by the local IBM team, a company that I spent 39 years with. Would you stand, please? Welcome. Thank you. I will leave you with five actions to take in your daily business lives to get what is wrong right. First, whenever possible, have a global view. Whether you are in Denmark or Chicago, think about how your actions will play out beyond where you are. Second, seek to understand and address differences. If someone is different from you, national origin, race, gender, faith, physical ability, sexual orientation, get to know them and see doing so as an opportunity to improve your talent pool, your team's performance, and your access to revenue. Third, talk to one another, not about one another. Fourth, redefine the concept of competitive mindset. They are our issues, not their issues, and we must address them together. And fifth, understand that success is measurable, but over time, not overnight. My mom is 86 years old. She's always told me to set high goals, but never reach for the mountaintop. If you fail, you may fall to the bottom of the mountain. Always reach for the stars, and if you miss, you may land on the mountaintop. Former U.S. President Lyndon Johnson said, "You will find meaning only by sharing in the responsibilities, the dangers, and the passions of your time." Stepping up to the global diversity challenges of today is our opportunity to reach for the stars and to share in the responsibilities, the dangers, and the passions of our time. This is our seminal moment. And the great nation of Denmark, through the presence, vision, and actions of the Danish Institute for Human Rights, is providing global leadership to respond to those challenges. Leading by example has always been the most impactful way to chart new directions. Please know that my presence here today is a personal career highlight that I will never forget. Thank you very much.
Could you give us a few moments on stage for answering questions?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much, Mr. Am I on air?
No, I'm not.
I am on air now. Thank you very much. Thank you so much, Mr. Charles. Since the rest of the conference will be in Danish, we will just put in a few questions in English now for those who might join us in this. Could I just ask, it might be a naive question. Now, all of our efforts in diversity programs, do we ever get wiser, or will diversity programs only enhance the possibilities of those who need it just now? I mean, if women get the place at the table, if they get what they earn, will we have a new kind of problem after that?
Men probably will. Because we seem to consistently not get it. But look, I worked at IBM for 39 years. I've been gone for 3 years. One of the things that I have been amazed at is that things that we talked about in the 60s, we still talk about. So lessons that we might have thought were learned, I continue to encounter dealing with the same issues, which tells me that generations of management are not passing down the lessons that we think they had learned. We're spending too much time teaching the same thing over and over. What that says to me is that doing it because it's right didn't work. Doing it because it was the moral thing to do didn't work. I believe that what has a chance to work is that doing it because it contributes to a survival strategy. Doing it because if we don't do it, we're going to go out of business.
No matter the issue.
Money is the issue. One of the things that I have trademarked is, I don't care who you hate, you don't hate them more than you love money.
So you put it into a common context, and the common context is business.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you very much. There is a possibility for questions. I have some kind of a microphone over here. Please put up your hand if you want to address Mr. Childs. In the meantime, I can just fill out with one more question. Of course, there are different traditions from country to country. In your country, of course, race has been a big issue in diversity programs. In this country, it will come up, but so far, social background and gender has been a much bigger issues than race. Do you think there is one answer to all the specific corners of diversity claims or diversity programs, no matter the issue, gender, sexual orientation, religious orientation, race, is there one answer to all of them?
No. I think, first of all, we must understand the concept of civil rights. America was born from a civil rights struggle. When they threw the tea in the harbor in Boston, that was an expression of civil and human rights. I think any time any group of people wants to deny any other group of people something that they have and take for granted, that's a civil right. And people are going to speak up about that. I always worry that Americans will lecture, that we will assume the right to tell other people what's wrong in their country, mm-hmm. when there are so many examples of things that we have not gotten right in the United States. What I encourage people to do is understand people where you are who are different from who you are, to get to know them. It may be race, it may be gender, it may be faith, it may be sexual orientation, it may be physical ability. In different countries, differences are treated differently. What I have found is that I have yet to be in a country where someone who's different is not treated less than what I would consider fairly. Mm-hmm. And that is the essence of affecting who comes to work, how they're treated at work, and how they're viewed as customers. That's why I want to get the issue on the table in the context of fairness. I just don't want to lecture you as to what's fair here or there. I want you to decide that. But I want you to see the world through the lens of whoever's being treated differently and let them have an opportunity to express their view as to how does it feel to be treated differently than how you treat yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think in that context, we'll have some enriched discussions around the world.
You mentioned the demographic thing in your speech, pronouncing white population to be a minority in like 30 years from now or whatever. Having that situation in 30 years from now, would you say that race as a diversity topic is not existing anymore?
You know, there are people who want to say that race is no longer an issue because there's a black man in the White House. His being in the White House does not define the solution, that a problem has been solved, and the minority community in the United States as a collective community becoming the majority will not. People ask me, when will this diversity work be over? And I say, I don't think it will ever be over, because we're going to have people who are different. And the issue is the need to continuously work at bridging differences, getting people to the table to talk to one another. And it's also important that as groups become the majority, that they not ever presume the right to treat people like they were treated. I think over time we're going to look back on history and say that perhaps one of the greatest statesmen to ever live was a gentleman in South Africa who spent 28 years in jail, came out to lead a country, and never preached hate. That's a message that we must all remember, that no matter what our circumstance, whether we're down or up, we must never preach hate. We must talk about the value of respecting people who are different from us and getting along so that we can survive together. Our inability to survive together is the going out of business strategy.
Thank you very much. Time for maybe one question or two.
We have a question down here from a gentleman.
Down here? We need some.
My name is Uwe Mbalasi. Thank you very much for the inspiring lecture. In Denmark at this time, it is very often debated how it comes that in the crime race, you see people with ethnic minority background, immigrant background.
Everybody got something out of that discussion. We've got to have discussions that will lead to respect. But we can't have police officers make an assumption that because you're black or because you're brown, because you're red or yellow, that you are a problem. But we must understand that poverty does contribute to bad outcomes. And if we can collectively focus on, and I think the best way to do it is through ensuring that everyone gets a quality education, we'll minimize the people who are poor, and we'll increase the number of people who are working, contributing to our tax base, and contributing to a talent pool that is in dire need of talent. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Mr. Childs, also for giving us this very personal angle and personal experience in your answering the question about the question you just got. Thank you so much for daring to be personal also in this strange country. Thank you very much.